Well, you may have noticed that the presentation said Patrick under the presenter. I am presenting this on behalf of a colleague of mine at the Miatech Corporation who was not supposed to be able to present today, but now he's sitting in the audience. Go figure. Anyway, yeah, there he is over there. So if you have questions, go harass Ryan. You will notice I'm with the Public Health Law Network Eastern Region now. I'm in my third week there. At the time that we wrote this abstract, I was with the Miatech Corporation. So these slides are on Miatech's, no, it's not letterhead, but template. I have no financial relationships to disclose. So just a roadmap of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to give you a very quick and dirty overview of the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act, which I will call the federal law for all of our sanity, and the new FDA regulations. We're going to talk about some challenges and opportunities related to implementation of the act, implications for state and local authority, and because we're part of the Health Disparities Panel and because it's a topic that's near and dear to my heart, some implications for health disparities. And we'll talk about some legal challenges as well. So the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act was signed on June 22, 2009. It set standards. Some went into effect immediately and some were phased in. It authorizes FDA to regulate tobacco products. Tobacco products are not regulated under the usual safe and effective standard that's used for other products under FDA's purview, but rather it's under a new standard called Appropriate for the Protection of Public Health. The law also expands, limits, and preserves state authority. I should mention, too, that the law required FDA to reissue its 1996 regulations, which we will also talk about. And here they were. FDA issued a final rule that became effective June 22nd of this year, called Regulations Restricting the Sale and Distribution of Cigarettes and Smokeless Tobacco to Protect Children and Adolescents. And as the name implies, they are focused on advertising access and marketing restrictions to prevent youth access and initiation. Specific provisions of the law include a ban on all flavored cigarettes. This was a letter issued by FDA in September. The one exception is menthol, and we'll talk a lot about menthol later on in the presentation. This includes all component parts of a cigarette, including the filter, the paper, and the tobacco. The law prohibits certain claims, including health claims. There's a rigorous review process for FDA when a health claim is put forth by a tobacco company. And also claims of FDA approval or implied claims that FDA has authorized or somehow reviewed the product and has deemed it to be safe. Anything that implies an endorsement of the FDA is also forbidden. The law prohibits use of terms like light, mild, and low tar, mainly because they are deceptive. And here's just a funny cartoon. It says, "Well, it's a good thing you changed cigarettes, Frank. You only have cancer light." So obviously, such claims are deceptive. The law requires a much more extensive disclosure of the contents of tobacco products, including ingredients, nicotine, and harmful smoke constituents. The law also requires FDA approval of all new tobacco products. And FDA is given authority to require changes to tobacco products in order to protect the public's health. By 2012, the law also requires large graphic cigarette warning labels that will cover the top 50% of the front and rear panels of the cigarette pack and at least 20% of advertisements. FDA has the authority to revise labeling requirements, allowing the agency to require labels based on the best available science without new action by Congress. The law is focused on youth access and preventing youth initiation. So there's very specific provisions that are intended to prevent youth initiation. And FDA is also given the authority to implement additional action in the future. Specifically, the law sets forth bans on tobacco sponsorships of sports and entertainment events. It bans free giveaways of non-tobacco items like hats or what have you, requires retailers to verify the age for all over-the-counter sales and provide for federal enforcement and penalties against retailers who actually sell to minors. It bans tobacco sponsorships of sports and entertainment events. I already said that. Why do I have that there twice? It bans free, I wanted you to really know that point. Bans free giveaways of non-tobacco items and restricts vending machines and self-service displays to adult-only facilities. The two that we're going to talk about with regard to a legal challenge were the ban on outdoor advertising near schools and playgrounds after further FDA review. This was a provision that was virtually identical to the Massachusetts law that was struck down in Lorillard. And so FDA has actually reserved that outdoor regulation. They're studying the issue now. And the law also limits advertising in publications with significant teen readership, outdoor and point of sale advertising, except in adult-only facilities, to black and white text only. This is the so-called tombstone provision. These last two provisions were challenged in Commonwealth Brands Incorporated versus FDA on the basis of a First Amendment infringement on free speech, and also Fifth Amendment challenges to due process and unconstitutional taking of property. The court in Commonwealth Brands, which was in the Western District of Kentucky, found the tombstone provision to be unconstitutional. And the challenge to the ban on outdoor advertising within 1,000 feet of schools, it found to be unripe because FDA has not yet issued those regulations. And all the other provisions of the law were upheld. The district court, with respect to the tombstone provision, found that images of packages of their products, simple brand symbols, and some uses of color actually convey important information to consumers, specifically what the product is and who makes it. The court reasoned that because the law could have made exceptions to the law, for example, allowing brand or manufacturer logos to appear, that the Act's blanket ban on all uses of color and images in tobacco labels and advertising has a, quote, uniformly broad sweep that demonstrates a lack of tailoring. So for that reason, that provision was struck down. And again, because the final outdoor advertising rule had not yet been issued, that was found to be unripe. So, impact on state authority. The law blocks most state and local regulation of the content of tobacco products. That's the main reason that the tobacco industry was in support of that provision, having to tailor themselves to one set of standards as opposed to 51. The law also includes limited preemption of some tobacco litigation, specifically failure to warn, negligence, and misrepresentation litigation. With regard to advertising, the law does block state authority to regulate the content of cigarette ads or product packaging or labeling. States can still regulate the time, place, and manner of regulation of advertising. So, for example, in the picture here, states can issue regulations or localities can issue ordinances that does not allow cigarettes to appear right behind a counter, for example. Mandates that do not affect packaging or advertising are okay. For example, warning signs at the point of sale are still allowed, and courts are likely to determine issues of commercial speech and interstate commerce in the future. State authority to engage in a host of tobacco control activities is still very much intact, and here's just a listing of some of the things that states are still free to do with regard to regulating tobacco products. Okay, so now the potential impact on health disparities. Again, states and localities retain a lot of power still to regulate smoking and tobacco products, which is really important because not every population in every jurisdiction is the same. And so the ability for a state or a locality to protect its own citizens with regard to their specific needs is intact and is very important. So again, the opportunity remains for tailoring legal and policy interventions to those most affected in individual jurisdictions. Specifically, I'm going to talk about menthol cigarettes. Okay, so clove cigarettes were actually included in the flavor ban. Clove cigarettes are comprised generally of 20% to 40% of ground clove, and the rest is tobacco. I don't know what that word is under the graphic there, but actually it says banned. sorry about that. Cloves were actually banned under the law. Menthol, however, was not banned, most likely because Philip Morris obviously very much vehemently opposed that provision of the law. Thank you. And in the interest of getting it passed, that was placed in there. Menthol is an artificial additive used to reduce irritation upon inhalation. And there's evidence that menthol actually reinforces addiction, makes it more difficult for the smoker to quit. And again, they're not banned. This is an interesting aside. Most clove cigarettes are manufactured in Indonesia. And so in April of 2010, Indonesia issued a complaint with the World Trade Organization alleging that Section 907, which is the section of the law that bans clove cigarettes, is inconsistent with a host of international treaties. In June of 2010, Indonesia requested a panel to hear this issue, and in September, I believe, it was the components of the member countries on the panel were approved. So that was an interesting aside. Okay, menthol is far more common among non-white smokers. 55% of black smokers used one of three popular menthol brands, Newport, Kool, and Salem. This is according to the Surgeon General report of 1998. Despite comprising fewer than 10% of all smokers in the US, black smokers comprise about 70% of menthol smokers. This has been the subject of at least one lawsuit that I'm aware of, using the Civil Rights Act to allege that tobacco companies were unfairly targeting minorities in their marketing of their product. The one that I know about was unsuccessful. A 2010 study of 720 black smokers in Los Angeles County, 57% of them were menthol-only smokers. After the survey, 28% smoked both regular and menthol. And among the menthol smokers, both the menthol-only and regular smokers combined, there was a pervasive belief that menthols were actually less harmful than regular cigarettes. There's some argument to be made there that the coloring of menthol packaging might contribute to that, because if you think of, you know, what if you're trying to market something as healthy, usually green is a really popular color to choose. Okay, and this is the fact that most menthol smokers are African American is not something that's a surprise to the tobacco industry either. This is an excerpt from a Philip Morris internal memo from 1978. And if you can't read it, it says, "We knew that blacks, females, and younger smokers were more likely to smoke menthol cigarettes than whites, males, and older smokers. Table 1 shows the magnitude of these differences." So this is a focus group study that the tobacco industry performed themselves. Impact on cessation. Again, there's research that shows that menthol smoking leads to poorer cessation outcomes among non-white smokers, even though black smokers smoke fewer cigarettes per day. Tobacco manufacturers are more likely to advertise menthol cigarettes in areas with disproportionately higher rates of minorities. They feature non-white models in advertisements, as you can see here, and I'll show you some more pictures as well, and they advertise menthol cigarettes in magazines with high minority readerships. This is examples of advertisements for menthol cigarettes over time. You can see they have not changed very much. The African American community is actually divided on this issue. The Congress of Racial Equality, the National Black Chamber of Commerce, and the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement testified before the FDA against a ban on menthol over concern that a ban could spur an illicit market for the outlawed products in minority communities where they're favored, driving a range of illegal activity and putting new burdens on law enforcement agencies. Days after this testimony, the NAACP joined with the Legacy Foundation and the African American Tobacco Control Leadership Council in favor of such a ban because of this evidence of disproportionate advertising. This was just an interesting aside. Again, the flavor ban applies only to cigarettes, so we started seeing that tobacco manufacturers are starting to switch over to little cigars and making them flavored. I'm not sure about you, but a sweet strawberry little cigar, I think, is probably targeted at a kid. Okay, so in conclusion, state authority to engage in a host of tobacco control practices remains very much intact. Opportunities remain for tailoring these tobacco control interventions to the populations within the jurisdictions that are most affected. The FDA retains significant authority to regulate marketing of cigarettes and tobacco products, and FDA has the authority to ban menthol outright, or at least to regulate menthol. The Scientific Advisory Committee for the FDA is actually currently debating this issue, studying menthol. They've required the tobacco industry to send them dose response relationships for physiologic effects of mentholated tobacco smoke with a host of other scientific indicators to help them make this decision. And these recommendations are due in 2011. March. And again, if you have any questions, contact Ryan Patrick. Thank you.